It's been a really interesting time to go through this series on grace. For some people, grace is something that we don't often talk about, or when we think about it, we don't give it that much weight. We don't think it's that powerful. But actually, grace is just one of those things that makes all the difference, and it's the main message of Scripture for us. And when we started this session, this series, 3 weeks ago, we basically said that we were inspired by the words of a Christian psychologist who said, the people that I've spoken to and the people that I've taken care of, the problems that they've had have mostly come about by two things. One is a failure to understand and receive God's grace for themselves. And two, it was a failure to give God's grace to other people. And we said in our definition that grace is God's riches at Christ's expense. And that it is something that is incredible. If you think about the difference between judgment and mercy and grace, then judgment is we get what we deserve. Mercy is we don't get what we deserve. God lets us off the hook. But grace is we get what we don't deserve. We get what we don't deserve. We get something which is so amazing, so incredible, that it's totally unearned. It's unwarranted. And all of religion is always about people doing something and being rewarded by God. You do your prayers, you do your religious duty, and God hears you and God helps you, and you get blessed and you get to be in the in crowd. But Jesus said that grace is all about you not being able to do anything. You just trusting in God. You relying on Him. And it's all about what He does for you. And so in that first session, we talked about Jesus coming to Nazareth, to the synagogue. And He has this incredible moment where He reads the scroll. And He talks and references this Old Testament prophecy when God spoke about bringing a brand new kingdom. And His good news for the poor is a year of Jubilee. And at the point where He's supposed to say it is the year of vengeance of our God, Jesus stops before vengeance. He just says it's the year of Jubilee, it's the year of the Lord's favor, drops the mic, walks out. Today, this is fulfilled in your hearing. And it's grace. It's incredible grace. It's grace that we don't deserve. It's grace that we didn't earn. It's grace that we weren't expecting. It's grace that is better news than we could ever get our heads around. And last week we had Claire over and talking about the fact that if God is so gracious, does that mean that it doesn't matter how we live? And she talked about that story of the prodigal son. And if the prodigal son messes up, lives a life and is not judged, then who am I or who are you to judge anybody for the way that they live? Because you can live the way that you want to live and God will still forgive you. That God will be gracious towards you. You don't earn His approval, you don't earn His love, you don't earn His favor. He gives it to you whether you earn it or not, whether you deserve it or not. So live what you like. It's impossible for anyone to say that what you're doing is wrong. Actually, we reference this verse in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 6, where Paul says, what then? Shall we sin because we are not under the law, but under grace? And he goes on and he says, no. And Claire last week, she said, look, the thing about grace is it enables us to face reality. It enables us to be vulnerable about who we are and what we've done. But secondly, it shows us the truth. Grace points us towards truth. And then it gives us significance. And so with the prodigal son, when he comes home, it's grace that puts a ring on his finger and says, you are a son, you're restored. It's grace that puts a cloak and a robe on his back and says, you are now put in a position of honor and love. You're fully welcomed in. You're shown incredible grace, and that gives us significance. So we don't want to lose that. We don't want to carry on sinning. It matters the way that we live because it has an impact on our own lives, on the lives of other people. And grace gives us significance. But what I want to do today is ask the question, if grace gives us significance, then what do we do with that? Do we just say, well, God has been gracious to me, God has been kind to me, God has helped me, God has shown me mercy and God has shown me grace, so I just say, thank you. I just feel good about myself and I just enjoy it. Is that where it ends? Because here's the thing. Now, if you're not a Christian here, if you're on the outside looking in, maybe you've been brought by a friend, maybe you're checking things out, you're kind of coming back to church after a while being away, You're exempt from this. But Christians, if you're here and you call yourself a follower of Jesus, you're not exempt from this. Because so many Christians have a reputation for receiving all of God's grace and doing very, very little with it. Like we just feel good about ourselves. We feel blessed. We feel really, really grateful. But we don't respond as much as we could respond. And so today I want to look at what kind of response we make towards grace. And actually, it fits in quite well. We call this title for this one, Grace in a Box, because we're going to reference the whole birth of Jesus Christ. It's the second Sunday of Advent now, if you follow these kinds of things, which basically means it's the run-up and it's the lead-up to Christmas. Sometimes people think, well, Christmas, it's just, well, it's a nice thing, it's good for the kids, you know, and we had that kind of, we were doing it in a kind of postmodern ironic style, when we had Ellie here doing the puppets, and the kind of kids story, and we were finding our inner Christmas child, and we kind of think, well, Christmas is just, it's one of those light, minor type things, there's nothing much in it, but actually, I tell you, there's nothing that shows the grace of God more powerfully, more potently, more clearly than the Christmas story. Listen to this. This is, you might not have ever figured this one out or worked this one out. But essentially, there's three different accounts of the nativity story, the story of Christmas in the Bible. Now, there's the account by Matthew, who is particularly focused on Jesus coming as a king with a new kingdom. Then there's the account by Luke, who's all about grace and all about mercy and the underdog and the outsider and the person left out on the margins. And then there's John. Now, John, really interesting. John is the only disciple that didn't end up losing his life for his faith. He was the last man standing after the Roman Empire figured, every time we kill one of the disciples, the church just gets stronger. You know, have you ever seen that thing in the Fantasia when they do the Sorcerer's Apprentice and they chop the broom? You know, and they chop the broom, and suddenly that broom is now two brooms, and it's dum di dum di dum di dum di dum di dum. They chop another broom. You know what I'm saying? Every time they cut one of the church down, more Christians would appear. Every time they executed one of them, more people would start following it. It just became big news. And so they let John live, but they put him in exile on an island on his own. But the life of John, and he got to be an old man. He was the youngest of the disciples. He became the oldest of the disciples. And when Jesus was on the cross, Jesus says, as John is there in front of him and his mother Mary is there, Jesus says, John, take care of my mother. And so John took the mother of Jesus, Mary, into his house and treated her like his own mother. And we know from church history that he took her, we think that they ended up later on in the church in Ephesus, and that he was with her for many, many years until she died. He took care of her. He was faithful to what Jesus asked him on the cross. Now, who else could talk to Mary to get the inside scoop on the nativity than John? John had Mary in his house. They would do life together. They traveled and emigrated to a different part of the empire together. And John had more opportunities than anybody to say, Mary, 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 what was it like? That first Christmas day, what was going on in your mind? Tell me the details. Give me the story. I mean, Luke, he doesn't say very much. He's more impressed in who was the governor and what was the historical. But tell me the inside story. Give me the inside. Tell me everything. And do you know, you would expect John's gospel to be the most descriptive when it comes to the Christmas story. But John, when he does his Christmas message in the first chapter of John, he sums it all up. He says, you know what you need to know about the Christmas story? Shepherds, wise men, the birth, all of that stuff. Look, the most important thing is it's all about grace. He says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. That's what John is saying. John, who could have told you more stories than anybody about the inside view of the nativity. John says, the big thing is Jesus, and he comes to the world in such a grace-filled way. Yes, he comes with truth. Yes, he comes with a message that tells us how to live. Yes, he tells us about God and his plans for us. But predominantly before the truth, there's grace. There's grace in every aspect and every element. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the nativity story and I'm going to show you grace in three different places. And if you got my email, you know that I said that I was going to show you three things that you don't know. I'm going to tell you three things that you don't yet know about the nativity story. Are you ready? Who thinks they know everything and there's no way I can teach you anything? Put your hand up. Okay. Thanks, Reuben. You can leave now. You may have already heard this, but for most of this, this is going to come as a bit of a surprise because we have a kind of traditional view of the Nativity. Even the story that we've had here this evening, it was delightful, it was charming, riddled with inaccuracies. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a little curtain and peel it open and see the truth of first century Palestine, what was really happening. See, we have things like this. We have the hipster Nativity. Who's seen this hipster Nativity set? You've seen this one where the wise men appear on segways. Mary and Joseph are taking a selfie as Mary holds her cappuccino. There's a 100% organic cow eating at a gluten-free feed trough. It's very, very modern. Now, you can look at that and you can say it's blatantly, historically inaccurate. I mean, everybody knows that hipsters don't wear, they don't use segways. You know, that's more like a kind of early stage millennial with a twinge of East Coast liberal. So it's not historically accurate. But actually, it's not that much better or worse than the traditional Christmas card images we have of the Nativity, which is fine. And I don't want to stomp down on your nice treasured childhood memories or thoughts, conceptions about the Nativity. But what I do want to do is I want to unearth grace. Grace in three places. With Mary, with the shepherds, and with the Magi. Whenever you hear about wise men, it's Magi. That's the term that the Bible uses. And each of those is a subject to study in grace. So let's take Mary first. What you need to know about Mary is that she was pretty low down on the pecking order. And so Luke, when he talks about Mary, he says this. Joseph went there, that's to Bethlehem, to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him. So they were not yet married. She was promised. It was a thing called betrothal. It was basically as binding as marriage in the old sort of Jewish tradition. You needed to divorce someone if you were betrothed to them and you wanted to call it off. It was a big deal. But she was pledged to be married and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. Now that's the biblical narrative of what is happening. And we have, you know, I blame the Victorians for this. They have their kind of twee little watercolor pictures of the whole thing. And it's been romanticized and kind of infantilized. And it's been bled of some of its shock value. Mary, we're talking about a girl who was probably around 14 years old. Put your hands up if you're older than 14. Okay, everyone. So this is someone who is pretty much at the bottom of the pile. Because in those days, the younger that you were, the less significant that you were. And if you were a woman, I'm sorry about this, but in that patriarchal society, even worse than our patriarchal society, women were just considered lesser, down closer to the bottom of the pile. So she's young, she's a woman, and now this horror, she is found to be pregnant when she's not yet married. I mean, this is a disgrace that no one will ever live down. By rights, she should be divorced from this betrothal. She could even be stoned according to Jewish law. And once that has happened to her, once you've had a baby out of wedlock, that is it. Game over. It is finished. You are destitute, you are on the edge, you are on your own, you are an outcast, you are a disgrace. You'd be lucky to end up a prostitute. At least you'd have something to feed yourself and your illegitimate child. And so this is someone who is very ordinary, probably, well, definitely illiterate, an illiterate, poor, peasant girl. And God says, I want my incarnate creation. I want my incarnate being to be born into the body of a girl who's at the bottom of the pile. Someone who'd be rejected. Someone who will have a stain over her life. No matter how many times she tells the story, people are not going to believe this. But God's saying, rather than having you being born in wealth and power with ease and comfort, you're going to be born at the sharp end of real poverty. An illiterate peasant girl. And then this thing about going to Bethlehem. So they're up in the north where they live in Nazareth. And they come down to the south to Bethlehem. It's about 5 miles outside of Jerusalem. And this idea that, you know, you've seen it in the nativity stories where she's heavily pregnant. She just gets to Bethlehem. And that very night, as the snow is falling, she gives birth in the stable, in the manger, the baby is laid. Because there's no room for them at the inn. And how many of you were in those kind of school plays where you had the tea towel on your head and you went round and they had to knock on the doors? No, no room here. No, no room here. Ah, here's the innkeeper. I am a friendly innkeeper. I don't have a room for you. There's no rooms left. And people would sort of rationalize it by saying, well, there was this census. Everyone was sent to their own town to register for taxation purposes, as Ellie very, very astutely said. And we have that. Listen, that is not how it played out. And that's not the way that it was set up. A small town like Bethlehem meant that there was no inn. And the word that is used is actually, it's guest room, which is why in our translation, it's translated as guest rooms. All modern translations of the Bible now find that because that's what we now know. We know what people have known for thousands of years, that for at least 3,000 years, homes in Palestine, in that sort of area, they were basically, most of them would be two-room homes. Everyone say two-room home. Okay, the first room is where the family lived. That's where they would eat. That's where they would live. That's where they would sleep. All the family stuff happened. So the whole family lived together in one room because they're dirt poor. And then they had another room that was exclusively given over to guests. To be hospitable was the biggest value that they had in those days, to be able to welcome in the stranger. And so when the Bible talks about Jesus with his disciples going into an upper room, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. We're talking about a guest room that's set aside for people coming in. You're always opening your home. You're always showing hospitality. So when Mary and Joseph come to Bethlehem, that's his ancestral home. They have relatives in that area. There's no way on earth that they would come to Bethlehem and be turned away. It would bring enormous shame onto that whole village. It would be an absolute blight on them. Their whole culture is about bringing people in, welcoming people in, showing hospitality. And what the Bible just says is that the place where they go to stay, there's no room in the guest room. There's no space in the guest room because there's another family there. And so what you've got is you've got this hard, scrabble, dirt, poor peasant family who open up their home to Mary and Joseph. But they've already opened up their home to other people. They're all jammed up in the guest room. Hi! And Mary and Joseph have to come in. Now, in the main family room, the main living space, which is the biggest space, what would happen is that they would partition off the end of the room by the entrance, by the door, and they'd partition it off with like a large collection of logs, wood, or sometimes the floor would drop down a level and you'd have just a couple of steps to go down to a lower area. Now, that lower area, that partitioned off area, that's where they put their animals. Very good. Gold star to Caroline Robery. They put their animals there, and they lived with their animals. They kept their animals in with them. Every family would have their animals. They may have sheep, or they may have goats, or they may have larger livestock. But what they would do is they would have them grazing during the day, and then at the night, kids, bring the animals in. And the animals all come in. It keeps you warm. It keeps them safe. And you've got this kind of partitioned off area. And it's in that area that they would have the manger. Now, the manger, two different types. Either it is carved into the floor, like a hollowed out area. Usually if it's cattle, it's hollowed out into the floor. If it's more like sheep that you've got, then you're more likely to have that traditional box. Grace in a box. It's a feeding trough. And so they clear out all the animal feed. They put some straw down or whatever, and they create a nice place, and they wrap this kid in cloths when it is born. And so as Mary, and you know, they had the chance to be there for a few days. When Mary finally does give birth, all the women of the town come in to help. They shoo out all the men. The men are all out there smoking cigars, waiting to come in. And then, that I have to say, that was scarily authentic, the birth scene that we had at the start of the service. I mean, she's given birth. She's a method actress. She went through that just to prepare for the part. I won't go there. So Jesus is laid either in a hollow in the floor or in a box. But the point is that this is ordinary folk. And what Mary is doing is that she is just allowing God to do all these things that disrupt her and, in a sense, ruin her reputation forever. And yet she is doing it in amongst a poor community. And so Grace says God cares for the poor. God cares for those at the bottom of the heap. So that's Mary. But the issue is, the shepherds are the next. And believe it or not, the shepherds are even lower in the pecking order than Mary. They are, if Mary is near the bottom of the pile, the shepherds are definitely the bottom of the pile. If you end up as a shepherd, congratulations, you can sink no lower. Shepherds, in the days of David the shepherd, it was quite a noble profession, and David was able to say, the Lord is my shepherd. But by the time Jesus comes along, shepherds, according to rabbinic tradition, they were considered unclean. So Jewish society, if you are an outcast, you're unclean. People can't go near you, they can't eat with you, they can't touch you. If you touch them, they become unclean. You're on a par with the leper that has to ring a bell and say, unclean. And then these guys would ring a bell and say, shepherd, because they were literally the lowest of the low. They were considered the absolute dregs of society. And so we read about them in Luke again. That same passage goes on. It says, and there were shepherds living out in the fields. Literally, they live in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. And then later on, when they'd seen Jesus, it says, when they'd seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. So shepherds in those days, they were just despised. You know, they were the lowest of the low. Gormless, toothless, hopeless, on their hills at night doing goodness knows what with those sheep. Absolutely rejected by polite society. You wouldn't want to have them anywhere near you. And yet God sends an angel to the shepherds. Do you know, I would imagine that Mary would be thinking, I really want to be in a nativity story where it's my neighbors the angel speaks to. And people like me who get to hear the message. And all my neighbors come knocking on the door with a little nice bottle of Merlot. And they come in and people like me. But no, it's the shepherds. And the shepherds arrive bedraggled and uncertain. And this is what the angel says. The angel says, look, a Savior has been born to you. Don't be afraid. This Savior, this King, you'll find him as a baby wrapped in cloths. In other words, this baby is wrapped in cloths, just like you poor peasants wrap your kids in cloths when they're born. He's a kid of the people. He's a kid of the poor. And you'll find him in a manger. Now go and look for him. And so you imagine these shepherds going through the houses in Bethlehem, knocking on doors and looking through into the manger area, the animal area. No, just ox. No, just sheep. Aha, baby. And then they go in and they all bustle in with their smell, with their uncleanness. And Mary's there thinking, I've just given birth. This is to save the world. These unclean people. But of course, come in, come in, come in. And then they go out and they tell everywhere. These guys were not used to interacting with normal, polite society. And yet, having seen what Jesus is and what he is about, they go out and they tell everybody. They tell everyone, we've seen him. It's true. It's real. And people are amazed because these are shepherds. And yet, they're telling a compelling story. And there's something about it that rings true. And all the time, it's grace, grace, grace. Because God didn't appear to the rich and the powerful, the successful and the famous. God went to the one that had messed up their life. God went to the one who had such small opportunities ahead of them. And he said, this is for you. This is grace. So we've had Mary. We've had the shepherds. Now we have the Magi. Mary is near the bottom of the pile. The Magi, the shepherds, are the bottom of the pile. The Magi are not even in the pile. They are so out of it. They are so much outsiders. It is not even funny. Okay, so let's look at what it says about the Magi. This is in Matthew. He says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi, everyone say Magi. Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. So we just look at that word Magi, just isolate that. The meaning of Magi is an astrologer, a sorcerer, a soothsayer, or a shaman. So let me just recap. If you've ever heard the song, put your hands up if you've heard the carol, We Three Kings from Orient Are, yeah? Whose favorite carol is We Three Kings of Orient Are? Yes, John. And John will be busking next week at Metro Carols out on the balcony with a little quartet, and you'll play, will you play We Three Kings?
Yeah.
Okay, great. It's absolutely fine. It's a fine, fine carol. It is totally accurate. We three kings of Orient Are. Apart from, there wasn't three of them. They weren't kings, and they definitely weren't from the Orient. But apart from that, it's a really great carol, and it's got a you know, really kicking tune and chorus and refrain. We say three because they had three gifts, but that doesn't mean that there was three of them. There could have been 12, there could have been 20. We don't know how many there were. The Bible doesn't tell us. They weren't kings. This word Magi. And from the Orient, you know, we have this idea that God and everything revolves around us in the West. And so when we think of the East, we think of China and Japan and the Orient, you know, the Orient, where the East people come from. Listen, where Jesus was, the East was Iran. So these guys were astrologers, they were soothsayers, they were shamans from Iran. They were people that looked at the stars. They were people that read the signs. They were people that tried to find out the dark, hidden mysteries. Now, I can't tell you enough how bad this was to a Jewish mindset. All over the place, in the Old Testament, it says divination is wrong. Soothsaying is wrong. Interpreting signs is wrong. Trying to find out the secrets of the universe by consulting dark powers or occult forces. Put your Ouija board away. It's unhealthy. It's wrong. And these people, when you find them, you were to put them to death, stone them. So in Deuteronomy, it says this. Let no one be found among you who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens. Anyone who does these things is detestable to the Lord. Now, the Magi appear to Mary and he pulls out his business card and says, hi, my name's whatever his name was. I'm a Magi. I practice divination, sorcery, and the interpretation of omens. Please, can I come into your home and put my book of spells and enchantments somewhere while I chomp down on my pork and lobster sandwich? I mean, these guys were totally, totally out of it. They weren't even the right religion. They certainly weren't the right race. They weren't the right nationality. They weren't the right anything. They were the wrong everything. Everything about them was detestable. And so you've got these Magi, and it says that they came and they asked about Jesus, where to find him. They wanted to worship him. And then it says later on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary. They bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, we're going to do more on the Magi. In fact, we're going to have a Magi trilogy. This is part one, just a little teaser, an intro. Then next week at Metro Carols, I'm going to talk about the Magi. It's going to be a short one, you'll be pleased to know, so you can bring your friend. It's okay. But we'll talk about what it means to be on a journey of faith. So this is going to be an absolute perfect, appropriate message for people that don't like perfect, appropriate messages. You're in safe hands. And then the week after that, we're going to have a little look at what the gifts actually mean. So Chloe's going to go through that. What's frankincense all about? What's gold and myrrh? Who knows what myrrh? So we're going to look at that and the thing behind that. But essentially what you've got is you've got people that were star watchers, they were astrologers, they were practicing the dark arts, and yet somehow God says, you who are in black and white, in my very scriptures, condemned as detestable before the Lord, you are now in a new era, a new covenant, a new time, a new phase. And this phase is a phase of grace, where somehow the barriers between people have been collapsed, and the barriers between people and God have been collapsed. And it doesn't matter that you may have not practiced things that God wants you to practice. It may not matter that you could have done all these things. Now there's grace to lead you out into a brand new life, a brand new experience, and a brand new relationship with God. And these guys get to be brought in, and the Bible says that they worship. So what we've got is we've got three people. We've got Mary, we've got the shepherds, and we've got the Magi. And each of them show a response to grace. They each receive grace, and as a result of grace, they do something very specific. So for Mary, she receives grace because she's a teenage girl in Palestine with no education, no prospects, in a difficult situation. And yet God says, I'm showing you my grace. And her response is, welcome. She welcomes in the shepherds. She says, it doesn't matter that you're unclean. It doesn't matter that no one else accepts you. There's a place for you here. We don't have very much, but let us open up our space to you. Actually, it's someone else's space, but we're opening it up. And when the Magi come in, she opens her heart up to them. Actually, these guys were politically dangerous because they were talking about a brand new king, and there was actually an existing king, Herod. He was a little bit stabby, murder of the innocents. And, they're just drawing heat. And you can imagine Mary there at the door, and the Magi come in. They say, yeah, first thing, divination, sorcery, dark arts, fine. Also, we told King Herod about you, and he told us to tell him when we find you. Great, okay, maybe not a great move. But she brings them in. She welcomes them. The shepherds, what they do is they witness. They go out and they tell everybody, this is what we've experienced. We've experienced grace. We've experienced God's goodness. We didn't deserve it. We were the last people that should have this. But he's given it. And so therefore, our response is not just to say, well, that was nice, wasn't it? I'll now become a Christian. No, our response is to tell everybody that we can. We have to tell everybody this message that God is loving and God is real and God is for the underdog. God is forgiving and God is compassionate. God is gracious and God is good. And they tell their story. A witness just tells what they've experienced. They say, listen, I know it sounds crazy, but we saw some stuff, man. We saw some heavy, heavy stuff. And then it culminated in this child, and there's something about that kid they witnessed. And then finally, the Magi, they worship. You need to know that Christmas is all about worship. Actually, Mary worshipped. We call it the Magnificat. The shepherds worshipped. They praise God. Luke tells us that specifically. And the Magi, even though they came from a different faith, maybe here you're from a different faith, or maybe you have no faith, or you're not sure about faith, but actually these guys, they came from that position and they came to a place of worship. Next week, when we gather together, we want to have worship like we've never worshipped before. We want to break the thing where Christmas is this kind of mealy-mouthed, cardboard cut-out, plastic, twinkly fairy-like LED kind of sham of the real thing. We want to have worship that comes out. We worship Jesus because God has come down. Love has come down and rescued us. We want to fill this place with worship. We want to fill this place with worship. And when we sing, O Come Emmanuel, when we sing Silent Night, we're not just going to sing it and go through the motions. I want you to come here and I want you to worship God with everything you have. Cool? Yeah. If you're, yes? Matt and Annie are up for this. We want worship. We don't just want a nice traditional tick box exercise. Now let me have my Toblerone. minus the Brexit scabs. What we want worship. Each of these things, welcome, witness, and worship. In our society, in our UK, a survey done in 2010 asked people, are you planning to go to church? 36% of people in the UK said, yeah, I will attend a service at Christmas time. And actually 2% said, I'm not sure, maybe if someone invited you. When it comes to witness, 75% of people that do come to Christmas services who are not normal church attenders, said, they said, well, why have you come here? I've come because I want to be reminded of the story. In other words, in the midst of Elf and whatever kind of monstrosity we had in that crazy trailer at the beginning, in the midst of what people still want to hear, a story of hope and God, of the transcendent, of the eternal, something that gives me a little bit of something to hold my hope onto. And then when it comes to worship, 94% of people that come to a Christmas service say, I've come, so I want to be uplifted. That's why we worship. We worship because we want to bring the presence of God. We want to say to people, there is a God and he loves you. There's a God and he's good. There is a God and he's ripped apart the wall that separated you from him. And he has cancelled the debt that you owed him. And he's paid for the sin. The consequences have been laid upon him. And it is wonderful. And he is real and he can change lives. So what I want us to do is I want us to go in next week with Metro Carols. It is our best, most wonderful night of the year. And I want us to engage in it, and I want us to not lose this opportunity. So we unashamedly ask you to really go for it. Why? Because at no other point in this year will 36% of people in the UK want to come to church. That's a third, more than a third of your friends. They will want to come to church at this point. This is like a unique window of opportunity, and we want to draw them in. There are people that are in this church today who found faith, who are significant to us and part of our community and love. And you know the first thing that they came to? Metro Carols last year. God does amazing things. So here's a big idea, and then there's going to be a big response. The big idea is this. Christmas shows us that the right response to grace is to welcome unreservedly, witness fearlessly, and worship wholeheartedly. In fact, will you say that with me? Christmas shows us the right response to grace is to welcome unreservedly, witness fearlessly, and worship wholeheartedly. In other words, I want us to say, in this church, in Metro, we welcome everybody in. We welcome everybody in. We welcome you if you're not used to church. We welcome you if you don't believe this stuff. We welcome you if you're an atheist or you're an agnostic or you've got no faith or a different faith. We welcome you in. We welcome you if you're not used to. We will roll out the red carpet for you and we will give you a wonderful welcome and experience. And that we witness. We want to say to people, this is the story. This is what God has done. And so therefore, I'm unashamedly inviting my neighbors. I've already got a couple of my neighbors coming, and I'm going to go to more of them, and I'm just unashamedly going to say, listen, on the off chance that you have nothing to do next Sunday evening, I would like to invite you to come and share a wonderful celebration with me and my friends in the heart of Bristol. We're going to have a wonderful, numinous night, a holy night, a silent night at parts. It's going to be wonderful. And then we're going to worship. We're going to worship God. We're going to create such a platform, and when we do with the band, I want you to engage so much that people are just blown away by the presence of God because they came expecting a few traditions and a few little kind of go through the motion stuff, and suddenly they discover, here's a bunch of people, and for them it is real. They're going for it. So we're going to pray. And what we're going to do is, you can see there's a bit of rustling going around. I'm going to ask the band to come up. And what we're going to do is we're going to pass out flyers. Now, we've got several hundred flyers left. I don't want to see one single flyer left in this building by the end of tonight. So the team, the welcome team, are going to come by, and they're going to pass down the rows flyers. So you take a flyer and you pass it on. But actually, what I want you to do is I want you to take at least three flyers. These three flyers will represent for you three people that you're inviting. If you want to take more because there's more people that live in your flat, or there's more people that live on your floor, or there's more people in your workplace, then fine. take as many as you like. But we're going to take these, and I'm just going to pray. I'm going to ask that God would use these invitations, these very small things, to touch people's lives and to bring people into contact with Him.